Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs, Tuesday, May 8, 1979, 8 a.m., Hearing Room A. Hearing on Senate Bill 199 relating to discrimination against injured workers, Senate Bill 202 relating to attorney fees in Labor Commission suits, Senate Bill 831 relating to interest charges.
No, we're going to take
how to do that.
831.
Farm Bureau's got insurance.
Okay, let's turn to Senate Bill 831. Do you have to sign up? Okay, well, our first witness and only witness is Kirk Henry.
Don't give me that stuff, Hal. I don't listen to her like this.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is H. Kirk Henry. I am testifying for this bill on behalf of the Oregon Consumer Finance Association. This association consists of virtually all of the 261 lenders licensed under ORS 725, the Oregon Consumer Finance Act. I am a member of the board of directors of this organization and its executive committee. I am also chairman of this association's legislative committee. I've been employed by HFC, a large national finance company, for 13 years. This bill amends the Oregon Consumer Finance Act three ways. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill tie the dollar amounts of the dollar brackets in the rate section. Instead of the Consumer Price Index, it should say to the Consumer Price Index. Of the Consumer Finance Act to the Consumer Price Index. Using the CPI of December 1979 as a reference. Now, this may seem like a real technical concept, but it's really not. We'll get into it later. Section 4 of the bill, pages 2, lines 16 to 24, adjust the brackets on loans of less than $5,000, and third, increases the maximum annual percentage rate on larger loans from 18 to 19.5%. The remainder of the bill will ask to be stricken. Before I get into the details of the bill, I want to say at the outset that because of some changes, or maybe I should say a little direction from the Division of Banking, we have prepared some amendments. At this point in time, instead of going through the bill and presenting the amendments, I would like to say that I think we should skip to page 4, near the bottom of the page, to talk about the need for the bill first. Also, I wish to say there are a number of people in the audience here from our industry, from all over the state, from Springfield, from Portland. And if you'll bear with me, there will be no other witnesses on this bill from our industry. I believe the only other witness may be Mr. Owen. Okay, now I'm on page 4 at the bottom. It says, why the need for this bill and how does it fit in historical perspective?
Where is that?
Bottom of page 4.
Oh, okay, I got it.
In 1971, the legislature increased the maximum loan size from $1,500 to $5,000 and implemented the present rate structure. Loan balances of approximately $300 through $670 received rate reductions at that time. In 1973, the legislature removed the maximum loan size entirely and established an 18% maximum rate for amounts in excess of $5,000. Since the 1973 legislature also amended the general interest statute to make it apply only to loans of less than $50,000,
our industry and the Division of Banking asked the legislature in 1975 to make the maximum loan size of the Consumer Finance Act $50,000 to coincide with the $50,000 maximum of the general interest statute. In 1977, the Division of Banking requested and received from the legislature several technical amendments to the Consumer Finance Act. Our industry has received an excellent response from the legislature. It is said by some that we have one of the better laws in the country. If that is so, why are we here today with Senate Bill 831? Time has passed, our economy is changing, and these changes affect different companies different ways. For some members of our industry who are in this room, this bill means the difference between being able to adjust to market conditions because of increased interest costs, continuing to serve their customers and surviving, or fairly rapidly being absorbed by larger companies. I recently attended a meeting and heard the president of HFC Canada state that 10 years ago there were 56 consumer finance companies in Canada. Today there are 14. Why is this so? Generally, four reasons. Increased cost of borrowed money, increased operating expenses, salaries, payroll taxes, rent, utilities, postage, printing, insurance. You'll notice that advertising isn't in that list. You'll see very little advertising from our industry next year due to increased interest costs. Third, increased government regulation, which some people call hidden inflation, inability to increase prices when required by market conditions. And the fourth thing is why we're here today. We have a maximum statutory rate, and when market conditions for our money costs go up, we cannot respond. What evidence is there that similar conditions exist in Oregon as in Canada? Recently, Public Finance, with about 450 offices in 30 states, is being acquired by HFC. Public has 12 or 14 offices here. Capital Finance, with 330 offices in the U.S., is being acquired or is proposed to be acquired by Beneficial Finance. Capital has 36 offices in Oregon, and I believe is the largest in the state. A few years ago, Granning & Treese, the forerunner of Grand Tree, the rental furniture company, sold to Abco. They had about 12 offices. In 1970, 67 of 216 licensees, or 31%, were locally owned and operated. By 1977, this has dropped to 43. A reduction of 24 locally owned and operated licensees. In addition to controlling expenses and obeying government regulations, the key to survival in our industry is maintaining the spread between the gross income expressed as a percent of loan account and the cost of borrowed funds. The name of the game in our business is leverage, or maybe I should say leverage based on controllable interest costs. I'm going to have to talk a little bit about my employer, HFC, to draw the comparison between our company and other companies. HFC is leveraged at a 3-to-1 ratio, saying in another way, for every $1 million in receivables, $250,000 is equity and $750,000 is borrowed. Conservatively speaking, savings and loans are leveraged at 15-to-1 and banks at 12-to-1. Let's go to chart 2A here. You have a 2A and B show HFC's operating results last year based on our cash assets and based on our equity after interest costs and federal income tax. 2B shows our return on equity. Now, we can go through these charts line by line, Mr. Chairman, and I'll take some direction from you on it. This chart includes our income from retail installment sales contract. I could not break it out. Our gross income as a percentage of loan account was 19.10%, less our operating expenses expressed as a percentage of our loan account, 7.71, leaving a net before interest and taxes of 11.39. Our interest cost, now this is HFC with its fine borrowing power, 5.93, in other words, on $1 million, we'd pay $59,000 interest. Multiply that by 48%, the federal income tax rate, and you get a return on assets of 2.84%. That's us. Return on equity, you start with the average loan account. You divide it by 4 because we're leveraged at 3-to-1. You take the 2.84, multiply it by the average outstanding. You should see what we made last year. I'm sitting here looking you dead in the eye and saying we made $500,000 last year in Oregon, $542,000. You divide that by the equity, you show a return on equity, of 11.36. Now, that's not a bad number, but 15 or 16% is much better. Okay, at this point in time, I was going to introduce the members of our industry who are here from around the state, Springfield, Portland. The largest company in the state with 14 offices. It's been here since 1922, and others. Now let's look at chart three. That's the next chart. The number three is buried under the paperclip, so the name of this chart is Average Interest Rates. This shows a variation in HFC's interest rates since 1952. If you'll notice that the unmistakable direction is upward. This is what we're looking at right here in case I've lost anyone. Now the bottom line there shows net interest expense of the finance business and average receivable. On the right hand side, you'll see that shows 5.93. You take the overall interest rate which we pay, which is the black line, which is 7.5%. That combines our long-term debt and our short-term debt. And you apply the 7.5% to $750,000, and within a few tenths of 0.01%, you get 5.93. So on $1 million, we'll pay $59,000 interest.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wingard.
You're borrowing money now at 7.5%?
No, sir. You see, we have a combination of long-term and short-term debt. We borrowed some money at 4% for 20 years in the mid-1950s, and that's still on our books. The problem is when that 2%, 4%, and 6% money runs out, we're replacing it with double-digit long-term 20, 25, and 30-year bonds. If I could move right on...
It's a mix that brings
it's
that
a mix
interest
of,
down.
Sure. The first quarter of 1977, we were paying a little more than 6% for our short-term debt. Now that's 10%, and I'll cover that later. Is it okay, Senator Wingard, if I just...
Well, that's fine. I just want to know how you got it to 7.5.
Yeah, that's, what you're going to see. Sir?
Pardon?
He was looking for the source.
That's
okay.
Right. That's
okay.
Right.
These are.
Sometimes we, you know, carry on little side deals there while we're.
Okay. You'll find most of our debentures listed on the New York Bond Exchange. Okay. Our industry conceived in the early 1900s when short term money was 0.5% and long term money was 1.5% or 2%. Now, if you can, I'll show you a chart later that'll show in the 1940s, long-term debt was less than 2%. And when we replace that, well, in recent years, HFC's 20 and 30-year money at 2, 4, and 6% has been replaced by double-digit 20 and 30-year money.
What were your interest rates in 40 that you were loaning out at, say, $500?
$500 loan would have yielded probably in varying from state to state, 33, simple.
36.
It'd be 36 to 300, generally.
1940, you were getting that?
Yes.
And you were borrowing money at 2?
Yes. That's the squeeze. Did you just put your finger on it?
That was 3%.
If I stop talking right now, he's just put his finger on it. That's the squeeze. Okay. Since long-term debt is available only to the most credit-worthy companies, smaller consumer finance companies are forced to borrow short-term at higher rates from banks or on notes from other investors. And about this other investor note, I'll hit this right now. The security statutes in this state permit people to our industry to borrow money from individual investors as long as the amount stays below a certain amount and as long as the number of investors is under a certain number. Okay, now let's look at charts 4A and B, what we're talking about. Chart 4A is dealing with compensating balances. And basically, we're going to take $1 million example, quote an interest rate of 12. That's $120,000 interest. 10% compensating balance means they get to use $900,000. So you get an effective rate of 13.3%. Now let's move to 4B. And this is a chart that shows what you pay when you borrow from banks in today's marketplace. And you see I've got a number circle there. For example, a 13% loan with a 10% compensating balance actually costs 14.44. And that is the narrowing of the spread. If you borrow all of your money short term and you have 90-day renewable notes and you're paying 13%, And the general rule of thumb right now is 1.5 over prime, which would make it 13.25. My chart doesn't go by quarters. It just goes 13.14, as you see. That's going to cost you 14.4%. We have one member of our industry who's paying the prime plus 1.5 percentage points plus a 15% compensating bonus for a yield of 15.59. Now, when your gross income is averaging about 19 or 20, you see the squeeze is on right there. Another member of our association is 2% over prime with no compensating balances. Now, the use of this chart is intended to show you how it is in a marketplace for some corporate borrowers. It is not an attempt to bring this credit to commercial lenders. Not at all. One trend that I noticed from preparing this presentation and talking to our members is that four locally owned companies are paying the prime rate plus 1.5 or 2% with no compensating balance. That's four out of about 40 independent members are able to borrow money from banks without the compensating balance, and it makes a big difference. I do not pretend to have a, this is sort of a, for the bank's benefit, I do not have, pretend to have a complete handle on the subject of commercial loans with or without compensating balances, other than to say there appears to be somewhat of a trend by commercial lenders in Oregon, in some instances, toward obtaining necessary marketplace yields without requiring compensating balances of small, locally owned, single-office consumer finance companies. Now, to put this short-term borrowing in perspective, HFC maintains millions of dollars of bank lines with compensating balances. But we don't use them, and we haven't for several years. Well, why not? Simply because it's too expensive. Our short-term borrowings are in the commercial paper market, and our bank lines are used to support these borrowings. HFC, with its fine corporate credit standing, paid 6.76% the first quarter of 78 for its short-term money, and now we're paying 10.2. That's 1 year we've gone up almost 4%, 3.5%. System-wide, HFC increased its loan volume 12% in 1978, but increased its net income only 2% due to a substantial or $14 million increase in interest costs. Another mathematical phenomenon of our industry should be described. Senator Wingard put his finger on it a moment ago. We have a graduated rate structure. That is, the larger the loan, the lower the rate, or the lower the yield. Since 1971, the average balance in Oregon has gone from $703 to $1,682.77. This, combined with an efficient operation, is tolerable because of the ability to increase volume. However, when the declining rate structure is combined with substantially increased interest costs, trouble lies ahead. Let's look at chart 5. And with my little black felt tip pen, you can't read that 1682 there, but it's 703 and 1682 between 71 and 77. The dark line shows the present rate, and the dotted line will show the proposed yield in this bill. We'll come back to that. It's time to be very specific. Chart 6 compares the present maximum cost of consumer loan sizes with the maximum cost proposed by this bill. Let's go to 6. Okay, we can go through this item by item if we wish by changing the brackets from $300 to $500 and from $1,000 to $2,000 will increase the maximum yield under this law. A $500 loan will cost $19, that's for 2 years, will cost almost $20 more, 82 cents. Now, we haven't had a change since 1971. $1,000 loan will cost about $1.94 a month. And you can take a look at the chart, and I'll pause just so you can look at it.
All these haven't changed since 71, are you saying?
That's correct.
All of these in this column?
In column number 3, excuse me, in column number 4 is the difference between the present cost and the proposed cost.
No, but the last time you had an increase was 71?
Yes, sir.
Even amounts over 5,000?
In 73, we authorized loans over 5,000 and established the present rate. That was in 75.
Well, that's 73 or 75?
73. In 75, we put the $50,000 cap on. In 73, they took the cap off entirely.
Why did you have the cap put on?
Because the general interest statute was amended to say that loans over $50,000 were not covered, loans under $50,000 were. We thought we had a potential legal problem with the general interest statute saying $50,000 or less and our law saying no cap. So we asked the legislature to correct it, and they did. I guess we should move on to chart 6A. And at this point in time, I just put this in because if I lose you on this point, I've really made a terrible error. I know the Federal Reserve Board has done studies that show that 98.5% of the people in this country do not understand what the Federal Truth in Lending Law did. Now, I'm going to create an example, and Senator Hannon, I'm going to lend him $100, and a year from today, he's going to come in and pay $108. Now, he will have paid 8%. Senator Groner, I'm going to lend him $100. I'm going to charge him $8 interest. Being a consumer, he makes 12 payments of $9. Senator Hannon will have paid 8%. Senator Groner will have paid 14.5%. This chart right here shows that the $100 principal, the $8 interest, when you make 12 equal consecutive monthly payments of $9, totaling $108, the yield is 45%, according to the Federal Truth in Lending Law. So when we say 18%, gentlemen, we're not talking $18 per hundred. We're roughly talking about between 10 and 11. That is just vital to the rest of this. The only time that Senator Groner would pay $14.5 for that loan would be if he made no payments for a year and he'd agreed to pay 14.5%. Okay.
Just a minute. If I borrowed $100 from a small loan company, I would pay, my actual rate of interest would be 14.5%.
No.
Well,
excuse me.
What are you saying?
Okay, Mike, this example is used to demonstrate. The reason I picked it is because 12 times 9 is 108, and it's a very clean example.
I'd be paying much more than that.
Oh, yes. If we charged you 36% on $100, you would pay us approximately between $20 and $21.
Well, that's what you'd be charging me. You're not going to lend me $100 for 14.5.
No. Well, okay, looking down here on the chart, I have two checks between 35 and 36 under the 12-month column. If we lend you $100...
What would it cost me?
$20.60.
Okay. And that's paying it on a monthly basis.
Yes, sir. It would be $20.60 per hundred per year. The annual percentage rate disclosed under the Federal Truth in Lending Law would be
36%. Actually, it's 36%, but it's on the unpaid balance, so it would cost me $20.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes. If you made no payments for a year, theoretically, you'd pay $36. But that's, our law requires us to require payments in equal consecutive monthly payments. Okay.
Mr. Chairman. How do you explain that to the people? You say very rapidly the interest rate is 36%, but your payments are only $20 a month.
We would say if you're borrowing $100 from us, and I don't have the exact, we'd say the annual percentage rate is 36%. It would be 12 payments of, let's say $10. $10 and a nickel. $10.05 equals $20.06.
Well, what bothers me is, sometimes you can say too much, and when you said 98% of the people don't understand the truth in lending law.
Well, that's what the Federal Reserve Board says.
Well, I'm trying to get at how can you explain it to people so they will understand it, and how can we write a law so that they will understand it?
I think that there is a lot of consumer information available from banks, from us, from the Federal Reserve Board. It's on television.
Well, you and I all know that when we go into the bank, we want the money, and we'll sign anything they throw in front of us if that's a roadblock to get the money. We all do it, and we do it because you guys say, and I say you guys, I'm adding the whole banking institution.
Sure.
You ain't going to get the money unless you sign your name on every one of those documents, and we don't make any exceptions, Unless you get a Harvard attorney in there to fight with them, you're going to sign every one of those documents. My concern is your statement that 98% of the people don't understand it, and I agree with you. I'm sure they don't, but how can we make them understand it without creating another volume of paperwork?
I think that the consumer awareness has really increased in shopping for interest rates. The forms are...
How many people do you find go from one commercial finance to another to shopping rate?
Well, I'm pleased to tell you that the company that I work for has been very successful with its second mortgage real estate program here. Instead of charging 18, we charged 13.2 with no points or other fees. We did extremely well with that. We had to raise those rates. We advertised them. We had people coming to us from other institutions.
I don't mean that. I mean the guy who needs, he doesn't want his bank to know he needs $500 to go to Reno. He's not going to shop that.
Well, the guy that needs $500 to go to Reno, that maybe I should talk about Easy Credit for a minute.
No, just tell me, nobody shops those rates. No, you say yes or no. I don't think they do.
I think that they do. I think more people are. I really do. I think more people are. That is why our share of the marketplace may have, as a percentage, been reduced in the past 10 years. I really believe that. With the banks, the savings and loans, and the credit unions becoming very aggressive in the personal loan field, we used to have 100% of the marketplace. Now we're down to about 20. That
for what?
Sir?
You said you reduced from 100% of the marketplace.
Yeah, in the late 1930s, our industry was the only industry making consumer loans to individuals.
Oh, I see.
Basically, in this state right now, the marketplace break is about 60% credit union, and we have about 20% divided among us and the commercial banks. And I'm not sure if the savings and loans were in that figure or not.
Well, we've gotten off here. All I wanted to do was try to ask you, and maybe you can do it some other time. I won't take the committee's time. How can we better give information to the public as to what is the actual interest rate they're paying?
Well, I think the Federal Truth in Lending Law requires these disclosures to be clear and conspicuous.
I know, but you just said 98% of the people don't understand them, so it's obvious we aren't being clear and conspicuous.
Well, that's a difficult question to parry.
Well, when I've been trying to ask it, you know, for 5 minutes, and I can't get it.
What about, and George, a question along that line, what about stating all interest charges have to be stated in the terms of simple interest? I think the people understand this, but you have discount.
We go both ways. We show it in dollars, and we show it in annual percentage rate. We show it in number of payments, and we show the size of payment. We get them.
You have to do in the Truth in Lending Act now.
Yes, we get them all. We show
it. You go to a bank and you want to borrow money in the car, they tell you lend it at you for you for 5%. In reality, it's 10%, or they say it 8%, and it's actually at 16%.
I don't think they do that anymore. I really believe that. I just don't think they can get away with that anymore, because the form has to show that it's...
Well, I don't know. I couldn't afford to buy a new car for quite a while, but when I could, why didn't... That's the way they stated it was in terms of discount interest.
Right. Now, Senator Wingard, I might... to say that when the Federal Reserve Board made these surveys, these were people on the street, not necessarily borrowers. These were random sample surveys. And I can't tell you what percentage of those people were using consumer credit. Now, maybe that statistic has changed. The Federal Truth in Lending Law requires them to make an annual report to the president. And what I quoted you is about 2 or 3 years old now. Whether or not it's changed since then, I don't know.
May I proceed?
Sure.
Thank you. How will this bill affect the operations of consumer finance companies in Oregon? The best I can do for you is to create an HFC model and assume something that is not true. That is, that HFC is now and would be charging the maximum rates. You see, the HFC loan account distribution of 60% of our dollars under $5,000 and 39.3% over $5,000. That is pretty close to the industry model. 36% of the industry, I'm told, has its money, or 36% of the money is out over $5,000. The present yield under 5 and over 5 would give us an aggregate of 20.70. Now, if we were charging the 18 on our real estate loans, and we're not, and the proposed yield would improve it by 2.76%. Then we should create a fictional company with an equity of $1 million, leverage the company at 3-to-1, and borrow $3 million. $4 million times the 2.76 estimated improvement yields $110,000 in increased income, and I'm sorry we have to turn the page. And within the last year, the prime rate has gone from 8 to 11.75. So you multiply the $3 million that's borrowed by the 3.75 increase in prime, no matter whether you were paying 1.5 over prime or 2 over prime, and the interest cost is $112,000. Although the increase in interest cost exceeds the increase in interest income by $2,100, in other words, you actually, if a guy borrowed all of his money and he's leveraged 3-to-1, he borrowed all of his money at today's rate, the rate in the bill today or the change in the dollar amounts wouldn't cover his increase in interest cost. Now, we can look at chart 7. And I'd like to just move by this one fairly fast. What I've done here is the average branch in 1977 had $800,000, and I've made some very basic assumptions. I've showed the various debt-to-equity ratios of some actual and existing companies. You see 3-to-1, 3-to-1, 6-to-1, 9-to-1, 3-to-1, the varying equity amounts, the amount of investor borrowings on the right-hand side. You see $450,000. That's called long-term debt for that company. You see the bank borrowings. Each of these examples total $800,000. Each of these would improve 2.76% if they charge the maximum rate. The estimated improvement in each example would be $22,000. You take the bank borrowings of each one. You show the increase in interest cost, and you see what happens to the increased income of all the companies of all the different financial structures. Now, what this has done, I've compared projected branch income with the increased interest cost by varying debt-to-equity ratios and varying sources of funds. Now, I made some basic assumptions. One, there's an average of $800,000 per office, and that's right on. And there's no increase in cost of investor borrowings, which you can't substantiate because it's going up. I've said that the maximum rate is charged by licensees, which isn't necessarily true because there is competition. And I've stated that there's no other increase in operating expenses, which isn't true. Now, we know what I'm saying is that all this chart does is show what the increase in interest cost in the past year will do, excluding everything else. So let's move on to another chart. Let's look to chart 7A. Interest rates go up and down. The only problem is that an earlier chart shows the trend that they never seem to go to the previous low. The long-term trend is upward, 7A and B. Now, we're in an interest rate period right now that's historic. And that is, we have the potential for double-digit prime rate in one calendar year that we've never had before. You may look at 1974 on the bottom of page right-hand side of 7A, and you see that part of 74 you had 6%, and you turn to page 7B and you see you had 11% in 74, you had 12% on July of 74, so you had a combination of 6% and 12% prime in 1974. Okay, then you can keep on going to the right-hand column on 7B, and you'll see the first in January of 78, you had an 8% prime. Now we're up to 11.75, which is, I don't know, 15 or 16 months later. Now that's the story, gentlemen. That chart starts at 1919, and it shows all the prime rate changes. Okay, interest rates go up. Excuse me, I've said that. Credit service is a function of rate. If the maximum rate is high enough, there will be competition in the marketplace. If the maximum rate is too low, there will be very little or no competition. Taking the microcosm of Oregon and making it the U.S. economy, the large national finance companies with only their short-term debt affected by increased prime rate will not be able to maintain 1978 levels of earnings during this year. Locally owned and operated companies, which have to rely exclusively on short-term debt and investor notes, view 1979 with a great deal of pessimism. Our industry must be strong enough to attract the money we need to lend to the customer. Without reasonable profits or income, we cannot attract those funds. It's as simple as that. We cannot set the rates of charge adequate to meet costs.
That should be plural. We must come to you to do that, and what we ask is awareness of the need for an adequate return in order we may raise the funds to meet the needs of the consumer. We do not control our money costs, but must compete with others who want funds. Competition relates to the price we pay in interest costs for the money we get and in the quality of credit available to the institution with money to lend. Unfortunately, maintaining a high-quality credit image is expensive, too. Substantial underlying stockholder equity, like the 3-to-1 ratio we talked about, a strong ratio of long-term to total debt, are necessities for high-grade credit. These are expensive, and that long-term debt service costs are higher than short-term costs, generally, and have been, except for a few specific times, and in those times, long-term funds are just plain not available to any but a few companies. In conclusion, the diversity of companies in the consumer finance industry has created a healthy environment, which in turn has fostered a more efficient credit distribution system. The broad range of competition has been good for the industry and good for the consumer. Despite high inflation, with rising salaries in particular, the operational improvements adopted by the industry have proven effective in holding the line in our major controllable expenses. However, increase in money costs can only be dealt with by increases in allowable rates of charge. And that's the message I want to leave with you. If the consumer finance industry is to continue as a viable industry, rendering the services that are so obviously wanted by our customers, as evidenced by their patronage, the permissible rates of charge must reflect today's money costs, particularly in larger loan increments. Now, gentlemen, for those of you who weren't here when I started with the need for the bill. I indicated there were some amendments that had been proposed because of a little bit different direction from the legislative council, from Mr. Boland. You have those amendments before you. Everyone does but me, I guess.
I don't believe we have the amendments here.
They're in the black book. Okay.
Here they are.
Okay, now basically, this is it's a short bill. The only thing we're going to talk about, only things we're going to talk about occur in the first page and a half. We're going to ask you to delete the last 2.5 pages of the bill. The bill, as I said, does the following things. It adjusts the dollar amounts and ties them to the consumer price index, changes the 300 to 500.
What do you mean, the dollar amount to the consumer price index? If the consumer price index, your cost would go up, or would you vary the insurance as the interest rates, as the consumer price rose?
The answer to your question is no, but it needs a little explanation.
Okay.
The way the consumer price index adjustment is.
So, let me ask another one. You may answer both at the same time. Why not tie it to the cost of money rather than the consumer price index?
We thought a lot about that. It varies so much, and we are so bound in by government regulation to change our forms. Every time we chart change.
So does the consumer price index varies so much.
The way this would work, Senator, is that once every 2 years there'd be a change, and only once every 2 years. In other words, what the bill does on page 1, line 9, is make the reference-based index, it says 1967, we'd like to make that 1979. I guess I should... What I should do is just go through these amendments one at a time.
Mr. Chairman, before he does that, I'd like to ask a question. Maybe this has already been asked. If it has, you don't need to answer it. But basically, you mentioned a diversity of consumers. Who are the consumers for these lending?
Our average customer.
Have you talked about that?
No.
No. Who are they?
Our average customer is about 30 years old. Half of them own their homes, about half don't. He's making $14,000 or $15,000. He's married. He's about 30. That's our average customer.
And what are they borrowing money for?
A varying number of things. More and more, they're using the equity in their home to make major
acquisition, such as buying a second home, or maybe a piece of property, or maybe a rental home, or you have businessmen using their second their equity in their home to buy inventory, or you have professional people who need the larger amounts for business purposes. Or for the smaller loans, the loans of $5,000 and below, approximately one-third of the type of loans where you get a customer who, you use the word consolidation, he has a lot of bills, which, and he has the income.
Who are these, the same average type person you're describing?
Yes, basically. Now, the average customer isn't going to borrow $50,000 on his $14,000.
What does the average customer borrow on the average?
I believe our average was about $1,800. I believe, it was down to up to $1,600 in 1977, and I don't have the 78.
How many of your average customers default?
As far as dollars concerned, industry-wide, Mr. Olin would have that figure. For my company, we had an extremely good year in 78, and we charged off a net of only 1%. That's lower than our national average of 1.5%.
How do you collect those that can't seem to pay? What kind of
if they can't pay, no efforts are made. Now, basically,
they don't pay. Let's say they.
If they don't,
you
pay,
decided
well,
they can pay, but they don't pay.
Right.
What do you do?
You make an assessment of their ability to pay. You talk to the customer. If the customer's willing,
if they got their house up, you can get that, right? You can get part of it.
If the customer knew what we'd do to avoid a collection action of that type, to answer your question, if they had their house up, yes, we could. But it's not our mode of operation to want to pay off the first and own that house. We'll look for the way for the customer to rehabilitate himself through time. The major causes of our problems, collection-wise, loss of income, illness, and marital separation. Three basic things.
How many second mortgages do you?
Well, that's the U.S.
You said something about lending on second mortgages. Is that a big part of your operation?
It is now.
Is it?
Yes, sir, more and more. 40% of our dollars.
40% of your dollars
in this state are under second mortgage.
Now, you said something about 13%.
Yes, sir.
Now, what does that, in truth and lending, what does that really work out to be?
Well, 13%. Between $7 and $8 per hundred per year.
And what percentage is that?
13.2. We disclosed in the spring of 1977, it was during the legislative session, and some members of our industry criticized us for it, but we implemented our real estate lending program. The $5,000 rate was 15.5, and the $25,000 rate was 13.2. Now, we used that from the spring of 77 until January of this year when we had to raise those rates. 17 at 5,000, and I think it's 15 at 50,000. So, because of the increased cost of money,
you're up to 15.
Yes, sir. The $50,000 loan is now 15% instead of the 18.
What's the $30,000?
It's between 15 and 17, Senator.
Okay. I thought you said 13.
It was until
it was.
January of this
now
year.
It's up.
Yes.
Yeah, January now. Okay.
Yes.
Chairman.
Well, yes. Senator Drunogoski.
In answer to one of the questions that Senator Pro asked, you said that 40% of your loans are on second mortgages?
40% of our dollar volume is outstanding, not number of loans.
Oh, okay. Let me ask you, you said that the average loan is between about $1,800?
About $1,800, I believe. I think Mr. Olin would have the accurate number.
Do you know what percentage of your loans are below $1,000? Of the total loans?
I could check nationwide.
Why don't you, Mr. Olin, come up here, and if there are any of those questions.
Why don't you let him finish, and I'll talk.
Well, I'll let him come up here anyhow, and if there are any questions like this come up, you can answer.
He's the boss. He's got
I would hope so.
We've got
I have no
doubt. We have doubts at times, but
okay. Go ahead. You're directed a question to
Mr. Olin. Did you hear my question that I asked about him? I was trying to find out, one is how many of the loans that they had were below $1,000.
Do we get information that way?
Yeah. December 77,
77, and I have to dig a little bit to get to 78 figures. It'll be up just a little bit. There were 29 million out of 22. It's roughly 9%.
Or below
1,000. Or 10% of their loans were below $1,000.
But in number of loans made, that was almost 50%.
That's right.
Now, he's talking volume, and I just said accounts. We're both looking at the 1977 annual report.
On the second mortgages, do you have an average amount that those are taken out in?
Do we have real estate? Mr. Owen will beat me to this.
About the total outstanding real estate loans, about $11,000.
That's an average?
Going in.
Yeah.
And those basically are in the form of second mortgages?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's all I have.
Okay.
Any further?
Basically, back to the bill. Section 1, I'm going to go back to page 2 and start at the second paragraph. While speaking to indexing the dollar amounts, which occurs in Section 1, I'd like to say the proposed language is adapted from language currently in effect in 5 states: Idaho, Utah, Kansas, Maine, and Indiana. Last week, the Oklahoma legislature passed indexing language using December 1973 as the reference base index, with adjustment in the dollar amounts, taking 1980. I understand the bill has already been approved. Here's what Section 2 of the bill, starting on line 5 of page 1, does. Line 9, if amended as we suggest, to make December 1979 as a reference base index, would set the reference base index. That is a typographical error. It didn't come back from the Legislative Council, right? You'll see on line 21 that they got December 79 in there. So I guess one of us made a mistake there. Line 10 through 20 say that if the consumer price index of December 1981 is 10% more than the CPI of December of 79, then the dollar brackets on loans of less than $5,000 will increase by 10% on 1982. In other words, if we leave the $300 and $1,000 in place, if it goes up 10%, the $300 would become $330 and the $1,000 would become
$1,100. Kurt, let me ask you a question here. In Section 3, it says if the percentage change between the index at 79 at the end of the odd-numbered year preceding the effective date of the act, which is 79, would that be going back to 77?
Senator, we're going to recommend that Section 3 be deleted. Section 3 on page 2, lines 8 through 14, be deleted entirely, because that's our mistake. It shouldn't have even been in the bill.
I think we're going to have to do is get a mocked-up bill on.
Right. We have... That's it for Section 1.
Okay.
Section 2 of the bill, we have some proposed amendments, and these amendments for Section 2 restore the present language in the Section 1A. The reason that we are making these changes to the bill and restoring the present language is that when we talked to Mr. Owen first, we thought we understood he would let the indexed amounts go above $5,000. Subsequently, we got the signal, no, sir, indexing stays below 5,000.
Okay.
So the changes to Section 1 of the bill restore the present language with the exception of adjusting those dollar amounts upward.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Trollen.
Strollen, have you seen these amendments?
Yes.
Are they acceptable to you?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, since the amendments are by the sponsors of the bill, why don't we move the amendments and have it mocked up and then look at it.
I think that's good. Senator.
I'd like to add one thing, two things really. On page 2, line 18, the word 3 on the right side there should be respelled with a small t. That does not appear in the amendment.
Okay.
Well, and on page 1, line 10, where it makes reference to subsection 1, it should say subsection 1A. And the small a must be added to make sure the reference base index applies only to loans of under 5,000.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Smith.
Regarding the indexing, why do we use the CPI rather than the prime rate?
I asked the same question.
I'm sorry. I was out of the room.
Okay.
Never mind. Don't go over it again.
No.
I understand exactly what
repetition's good, Senator Smith. I'd like to hear it again.
All right. Basically, we have experience with adjusting the dollar amounts in the rate sections every 2 years in 5 states. We know that it works. It's fairly simple.
You use CPI in 5 states?
Yes, sir. In the Idaho, Utah, Kansas, Maine, and Indiana. We do it right now.
Is it the national CPI or the Portland?
No, sir. It's the
do they need that capital letter out there?
Page 1, line 6 of the bill. Consumer price index for urban wage earners and clerical workers. U.S. city average, all items, 1967 equals 100. Now, maybe some member of the committee is going to say, well, hey, that changed last year. Well, it did. That is why we have lines 21 through 26 in there, which shows how this is adapted if the Bureau of Labor states.
Well, now, I understand that you're doing it in 5 states. I want to know why you're doing it in 5 states. Why aren't you using the prime rate?
Overall money costs are not related to prime rate changes. Overall money costs are a reflection of long-term borrowing, say your 20-year borrowings.
You're better off with the CPI than you are with the...
Yeah.
That's how we have it.
Okay. Very much. Okay. That's...
I'll
give you an example. In Alaska, they've tied their state general interest statute to the certain percentage of number of points above the Federal Reserve Board discount rate in Seattle, and it changes every quarter. And the first business day of every quarter, those guys go to work not knowing what their maximum interest rate is. And then they've got to change their rate charts and their forms. They've survived it, though. So we would prefer to change our forms once every 2 years as opposed maybe to another system such as court.
Can I ask the commissioner a question, Mr. Chairman? Is this the first time that we've tied any interest rate to a consumer price index?
Of course you haven't yet.
Could I
understand? Now, just a minute. there are, I know the Federal Land Bank floats its rate of interest on the prime. That's the only figure that I know of that we've tied interest rates to. Is that, in your knowledge?
That's partial. So we also have on the paying side, as you're aware of, on savings, long-term savings are tied to the federal bill rate.
Okay.
I think the major consideration that may have been overlooked here is what's really happening when interest rates move as they do. You're very much aware that the prime rate has gone up. I don't see anything in sight that's going to tell us it's going to go down immediately. Long range it will, but it'll go down to a higher plateau than the last one. But the two ingredients that are happening that kills any financial institution is the squeeze they get in because of paying costs. Whether it's the cost of their money, number one, and the cost of their labor. And so unless you tie it to some kind of an index that reflects that, well, you kind of get into deep trouble on that problem. And that's what it's all about.
You're saying if the prime ever does go down, which it probably will under some sort of political pressure, it doesn't reflect the real inflation rate.
No, we can't speak in terms of prime and looking at any of these charts that will ever go down to 2%, 1%, as we remembered in pre-war years. It just isn't realistic. Relatively, maybe 7 or 8% is a realistic figure that will go down to
5%.
Would you?
Yes.
May I respond just a moment to Senator Smith? Actually, the interest rates aren't being adjusted. The dollar amounts are being adjusted. The interest rates stay the same. It's a little technical, but that's what the bill does. It doesn't change the interest rates. It does change the overall cost, but the interest rates in the statute stay the same as the dollar amounts that change.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Trove?
Senator Smith, do you mind if I, along the line with your questions, if the prime rate should go down significantly, the CPI should continue to go up, as it seems to do. Mm-hmm. Is there a possibility for windfall profits in this kind of situation or not? Now, Mr. Olin.
Okay. The answer is yes and no.
Well, tell me about the yes.
Okay. On the yes side is a possibility. On the no side, we found that when we took the ceiling off in the earlier years and raised it to 5, and then we went beyond that, and then they started to consolidate their loans and get larger loans, that rates went below the statutory rate because the marketplace, they're each out there buying for business. If there's a plethora of money is readily available, they will bid themselves into lower rates, and the consumer is in a buying position. When you get into tight money, you get into the situation you're talking about. The thing that usually happens is that money dries up and the money just isn't available at any price. And we're going through that period right now.
But if they have money and then that situation occurs, then and there's demand for it, there will be windfall profits. Now, I want to ask you another question related to all of this. Is this two questions? One, I know you think about the health of these financial institutions. That's part of your responsibility. But I would assume that your responsibility also is to think about the consumer and whether or not this is fair to the consumer.
That's the primary impact of the bill.
Okay, all right.
The law.
All right. Do you think it's, as the commissioner, do you think this is fair? This change that's being proposed in this bill is fair to the consumer?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
Okay. Now, another thing. By hooking all of this to CPI, are we retarding inflation or are we just simply encouraging inflation by doing it? Now, everybody supposedly wants to get a handle on those inflationary pressures. Are we getting a handle on them or are we encouraging them?
The real cause of inflation isn't in this.
Well, I know. It's not government spending either, at least here. But
it's not that. But
everybody's trying to do is this.
I don't regard this as inflationary as long as we have a marketplace where many companies compete. If we had a monopoly of companies, I'd be scared to death, but we don't have that. We've got 260-some. We've got about 60 various corporations with various license offices, and we've got banks and credit unions all out there competing for this consumer's loan. So I think the marketplace is going to be the real one that puts the hasp on your concern.
Okay. Now, you're saying you think it's fair to the consumer, but I want you on record to do this.
Yes. If anything gets out of hand, it's a nice thing about this state. We can come back next year
But in the meantime, some outcome.
I don't have the fear of runaway windfall anything on something like this with the type of money situation we have in this country.
Okay. Good. Glad to hear it. I move the amendments.
Okay. Senator Crowe moves we adopt the amendments. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hanlon?
Aye.
Senator Hannon? Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Kroll?
Aye.
Senator Wingard? Senator Kulongoski? Senator Groner?
Aye. Motion's carried.
Mr. Chairman, I think we ought to see the bill when it's amended and look at it again.
There's one other question I have, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Smith?
Are you familiar with the industrial bank bill that we've been discussing?
Yes, sir.
Does HFC own an industrial bank?
One. One in one state with four branches.
Are you in favor of the industrial bank bill that's here?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Smith, will you yield to a question?
Yeah.
Are you?
I am not, Mr. Chairman, and I think that this bill ought to be looked carefully. We ought to carefully examine this bill with the industrial bank bill. That's what I'm getting to.
I was being facetious.
Well, I wasn't. I was serious.
Are there any more questions, or do you have anything further to say?
Just one thing.
Okay.
Senator, you asked about the prime rate going down and windfall profits. The last time we entered the New York bond market was, we're on for $50 million yielding 10.5% due 1994, so the prime rate could go down to anything. We're still paying 10.5% on that $50 million.
shall we take that? Is that
good? MIT.
Is there any further questions?
Am I excused, sir?
If not, why, we'll have another hearing on this and with the bill amended.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to Senate Bill 202, and we just... Bob Steen, Department of Labor, is it in your book? Do we have it in here? Okay, get it. This bill is on the table, and we'll need a motion to take it off the table.
So moved.
Senator Smith moves that Senate Bill 202 be removed from the table. Are there objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Okay, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, I have a very sharp testimony here.
Would you give your name and your position for the record?
Robert Steen with the Bureau of Labor. Senate Bill 202 will allow the court discretion in the awarding of attorney fees for the prevailing party in wage claims concerning overtime and minimum wage pay. Currently, ORS 653.055 requires the Bureau of Labor to pay attorney fees to the prevailing attorney when wage claims suits are taken to court. However, if an employee files a wage claim to a private attorney to recover overtime or minimum wages, the employer and the employee loses that suit. The employer is not entitled to attorney fees. The law only makes the Bureau of Labor liable for attorney fees and wage claim suits. Also, as amended through this bill, the bill will then accept suits brought against employers who have failed to pay minimum wage or overtime. The bill would not bring a suit under this section if there appeared to be any doubt as to the outcome. All other wage claim suits would then be handled through ORS 652. These amendments would not lessen the responsibility for the enforcement of wage claims, but they will give the court's discretion in awarding fees to either prevailing party.
This is something I feel for. Okay, let me say this. Ways and Means wants this bill, and it and.
Excuse me, Senator.
Oh, is this a bill?
No.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, finish the testimony.
No, I'm sorry. That's 201, right?
Right.
Okay.
Just like I indicated in the testimony, this is a situation where if the bill does bring suits against an employer in terms of wage claims, the bureau in the past has been held responsible for paying attorney fees. This would not happen if a person got a private attorney and then attempted to do the same thing and lost. They would not be held responsible. So through this bill, we are asking for consideration, the same that is given to private individuals in terms of our wage claim suits, not to be held responsible for attorney fees unless the judge or the court does determine that is necessary.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Smith.
Bob, the state sets up a budget for the labor commissioner, and a portion of that is to pay attorney fees it's to pay for the Attorney General's assistance in any suits brought by the Department of Labor.
Correct.
So we also set up a budget for the AG. Isn't this getting another piece of flesh out of an individual whom the labor commissioner sues, and then the court may award attorney fees for the state as well as the damages to the individual?
We would not anticipate, and it has not happened in the past, where the state at least with the Bureau of Labor, where the state has awarded attorney fees back to the Bureau. We do pay, just like you mentioned, for our own attorney fees to the Attorney General's office, mm-hmm. but we have not been receiving attorney fees in terms of winning, being the prevailing party in a lawsuit, getting fees right. from an employer.
Well,
all that we are out for in this suit is just the wage claims for the employee and not for attorney costs to pay our AG costs. What has happened in the past is that, especially back in 1978, there were a couple of cases where the Bureau of Labor did lose wage claim suits. And we had bills, one bill in particular for attorney fees was $3,000. Based upon the current law, the judge had no discretion in awarding the attorney fees or not. The Bureau had to then come up with $3,000 to the attorney for the employer.
I guess I don't understand. The language on page 3 to me appears that the court may allow the prevailing party attorney fees, which the prevailing party in this case is the Department of Labor. And isn't it true that for the first time you'll be getting attorney fees as well as any damages that you may prevail in when you if you win the case?
Okay, here again, Senator, it does say in its discretion, and like I mentioned, we would not ask for attorney fees in the wage claim suit. All that we would ask for was just the payment for the wages that the employee is seeking.
But you would have the right to under this bill.
Correct.
Why would you want the bill if you're not going to ask for attorney fees?
Again, like it's, this would then give the judge the discretion in making that. We're not asking for that section.
Well, unless you ask for it, the judge is not going to give it to you. I wouldn't think. Woody? So the bill is superfluous, then, I would think, if that's your interpretation. Well, what I'm saying is that the judge, if you win your case and for the employee, and the judge, unless you request, the agency requests attorney fees,
mm-hmm.
I don't think the judge is just automatically going to say, well, we're going to give you attorney fees unless that's requested in the... What does that mean, counsel?
Got to ask for it.
Got to ask for it.
Right, okay.
What did you say? Well, they wouldn't ask for it.
Well, that's not what we're doing. We're saying but if we lost the suit, the judge would then have the discretion in not asking us to have to pay attorney fees to the employer and his attorney. That's the discretion that we're asking for through this bill.
Okay. Any further questions? Do you wish to take any action on this bill today? If not, we'll go to the next bill. You wanted 201, I think.
201.
You have that in there.
That's the one that wants to go to.
That's the one that wants to, that Ways and Means is requested.
Okay, well, that was 201.
Do you have a copy of 201?
Nobody does. Do
you have copies of 201?
This is. We need a motion to re refer to 54 for a referral. Nobody has it.
There.
This is one of these.
This one is.
He's got it.
He's going to read it aloud to
me. Yeah, good. Give me the kicker section. Forget
yeah.
Okay.
Introduction.
Transfer the appointing authority over wage and hour commission from governor to labor. Oh.
We tried that one the other day, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
And that one didn't fly.
What does Ways and Means want that for?
Okay. This bill, the Bureau of Labor placed in 201, which is transfer the appointing authority from the governor to the labor commissioner for the appointing of the Wage and Means Commission. We're in the process of going through our, This bill transfers the appointing authority of the Wage and Hour Commission from the governor to the labor commissioner. The Bureau of Labor is in the process of going through Ways and Means on its budget hearings now. We indicated two Ways and Means that there have been a number of expenditures caused by the Wage and Hour Commission, which have not been budgeted in the past, but the Bureau of Labor is responsible for. In looking at this, the Ways and Means Committee then for the first time are providing revenue for the Wage and Hour Commission, and because of this, they do want to take a look at this bill in Ways and Means. This was their request. We had nothing to do in asking for this.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Senator Crowe.
What authority does the Labor Commission have over the Wage and Hour Commission? Any? None at all?
None at all. I think that's a typical example has taken place this week over the subminimum wage for youth. We went in with a recommendation against that, but that was all we could do. The Wage and Hour Commission came out with that ruling.
So they're autonomous, and this would then give the Labor Commission substantial authority over it if the Labor Commissioner appointed the members.
It would have that effect.
In what way would that be good, and what way would that be bad?
I think it would be good because, in terms of revenue, we can then
control our expenditures.
Control the expenditures.
But are those expenditures really all that great?
Of course, the last biennium, we ran up $82,000.
And how much do you think you could lop off of that if you controlled
it? As well as staff time, which we were looking at 80 hours a month in terms of staff time.
You think you could lop quite a bit off of that?
There are other items, too. For instance, they can request Attorney General reports. They can request Attorney Generals to be at their commission meetings at $37.50 an hour.
And does that come out of your budget?
Which comes out of our budget also. Many of these functions and requests are repetitive.
Can you refuse those?
Not now, we can't.
Not now, okay. So that's the drawback. What would be the advantage, other than those financial advantages? I can see some disadvantages, maybe, in terms of the autonomy of the board. Don't we want that board to be pretty autonomous?
I think in terms of, we would not want to regulate the board, but we would want to, the bill, I don't have a copy in front of me either, and I don't think you do. The bill just says we would want to have the appointing authority. We would not want to sit down and say this is the rulings that you would come out with, this is what we are expecting. But we would want to have some input into the areas that does affect, the areas that do affect the Bureau.
It seems to me, though, that the arguments that you're presenting, the financial arguments, the Attorney General's opinions, all of those things could be rectified maybe in some other way than going the route of giving to the commissioner the appointive power, which seems to me the decisive power over the commissioner, doesn't you?
Well, there are other things that come also, like in terms of this decision, there is no one who has the responsibility for the commission. They're appointed by
The governor would, wouldn't he, if he does the appointing?
That's what we would think, but this has not taken place. There was no input or conversation with the governor in terms of this subminimum wage. He has the appointing authority and he places people on the commission, but that is the last contact that does take place.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Bob. Next bill is Senate Bill 199. Bob, you want to lead off on that?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Would you just, there's a group of students. Would you mind if I just...
No, you want to make a little...
Please, could I, Mr. Chairman?
Are you from Lane County?
Where are you all from? Portland. You're in the Senate Labor and Business Consumer Affairs Committee. The chairman is Senator Groner, who is from Clackamas County. On my immediate left is Senator Bob Smith from Burns. On my far right is Senator Cliff Troll from Corvallis and Senator Chuck Charles Hamlin from Clatskanie. Cornelius.
No.
I can't ever remember where he's from.
Washington County. Mountaindale.
I was going to say Eugene, but he'd really get mad at me if I told
him. I think Shedrick.
From Mountaindale. He's from up in Clatskanie County.
About staff? I think you ought to introduce them to.
Oh, these are our two lawyers, the two people that probably give us more advice than anyone else. And my name is Ted Kulongoski, and I am from Junction City. The bill before you is Senate Bill 199, and the bill is at the request of the Oregon Bureau of Labor. Mr. Steen is the assistant, Bob, what is your title? Executive assistant to the Commissioner of Labor, which is Ms. Wendy Roberts.
Okay.
And they have a bill in that would add various acts of discrimination against injured workers to the category of unlawful employment practices. And what that means is that the Bureau, the Commissioner of Labor, has certain authority to prevent or to take action against people who commit unlawful employment practices. And what this bill does is add certain other acts to that authority of the Commissioner of Labor to enjoin certain acts against people who take certain discriminatory actions against employees. And that's what you're going to hear about right now. Hope you have a good day.
Okay. Robert?
Mr. Chairman, if I may ask about...
Oh, first we need a motion to take this off the table.
That's so moved,
Senator
Chairman.
Senator Kulongoski moves Senate Bill 199 be taken from the table. Are there any objections? Hearing none is ordered. Okay, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask about the consideration on Senate Bill 201? I didn't...
201, I'm afraid that there's only one thing lacking, and that is votes, Bob.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear you express that. Okay. On
at the present time, you're going to have to do a little lobbying on it or work on it, and you can talk to the members
gotcha.
At any time when you have them, why we'll bring it down here again.
Okay. Senate Bill 199. The purpose of Senate Bill 199 is to provide legal protection to any injured worker who has received a medical certificate to return to work and the employer refuses to reinstate the employee to a previously held position, as well as to extend the legal protection to any injured worker who has A, received a medical certificate to return to the duties of a related position, and B, meets any required collective bargaining agreement, but the employer refuses to employ the person in available and suitable work for which the employee would be qualified. These definitions are current statutes under ORS 659-400 to 659.435, the civil rights of physically and mentally handicapped. Other provisions under this section, which pertain to injured workers, are currently included as violations of unlawful employment practices, and the related sections of reinstatement of injured workers and the employment of injured workers to available and suitable work should also be included in this section. When declaring the public policy of Oregon and guaranteeing the civil rights of physically and mentally handicapped persons, the legislature stated that the fullest possible participation in the social and economic life of the state should be granted to handicapped persons as well. If it is not an unlawful employment practice for employers to refuse to reemploy workers who have been injured on the job, this policy will lose much of its force. Senate Bill 199 will ensure the right of the injured workers to return to work and thereby carry out the public policy of Oregon. Briefly, what I'll do is walk you through the bill in terms of the amendments.
Okay. Okay, you walk us through quite quickly, will you, Bob?
On page 2, line 11, is basically changing, making referring back to neutral terms. The same as on page line 16, as well as 25. On page 3, line 7, we are including, like I mentioned in my testimony, The 659.15 and 659.20, including them under employment, unlawful employment practices. 659.410 and 659.425 are currently listed as unlawful employment practices.
I might say I like one phase near intent. Senator Grunogoski would be interested in this too, and members that they be an injured worker who is returned to work is approved by the doctor, the employer would have to hire him back. It would seem to me this would be a saving on workers' compensation if the employer was, and that's a thrust of this House bill, too, is to require that this.
Senator Groner, if you remember correctly, I'd like to inform the other members of the committee, is that if you look at page 4, section 3, which are lines 7 through 22, when in 1973, when I was occupying a position very similar to Rocky's and in the legislature, and I worked with Senator Groner, who was then the chairman of the Senate Labor Committee, that particular statute was written with the help of the chairman in 1973 and was put into the law with the intent that we understood it, that it was going to require the employer to hire injured workers back if, in fact, one, the doctor said to their former physician, the doctor said he can perform the job, and if he didn't, couldn't perform that job, then they had to have a job that was suitable for him to do. The labor commissioner, if you look on line 9, Mr. Stevenson interpreted the which is available and suitable to be extremely limiting, and that even if the claimant was entitled to go back to work as far as the doctor saying he's physically able to perform the job, the commissioner of labor at that time interpreted which is available and suitable to mean only if there was a job available for him. And so, in other words, if he was replaced while he was injured, he didn't have to take him back. Now, I would also tell you that the Representative Crest Workers' Comp Package has as its focal point this particular concept to hire these people back. And I think it's a good idea, and I personally think that the bill is a good one in the sense that it probably, what I have always fought for, to try to consider good public policy in these worker comp cases to get these people back to work. And I think it's a good idea, and I just wanted to tell you a little history of what the bill came about from.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator.
Question, Senator Kulongoski. The language in line 7 through 11 doesn't seem to change anything except the gender thing.
No, that's exactly right. And that's why I'm not proposing that we change that at all right now, because Representative Crest has his bill.
You wouldn't also see which is available and suitable?
Well, I tried that last time.
What language in this bill does change something? Is the language on line 13?
Yes, the line
what
13.
Do that do?
In fact, it gives the Commissioner of Labor the authority under the section that as it ties back in to all the remedies that the Commissioner of Labor can bring in action to if in fact that the claimant contends that his doctor says he is able to go back to work and the claimant knows that his job is there and the employer still says no, I'm not going to take you because, in essence, discriminated against him because he's got a previous injury.
Are you saying that the commissioner does not now have the powers to enforce 654.415?
I had always, very truthfully, Chuck, I had always assumed that it did.
No,
but I don't
not.
Think that they have it expressed. And what they did was someone, I think, raised the issue of whether the statute gave the commissioner of labor the authority to, and when you read it, there was no tie-in claiming it was an unfair employment practice.
The language is shall, the employer enjoined to do it. Now, there must be some sanction somewhere along the line.
And I think the only sanction was that if the claimant wanted to, he could go to court and file a lawsuit in civil court and try to get his job back. That was the provision. And I think that's what you're after. Because
by making an unlawful violation of the unlawful employment practice, it would give the strength in the commissioner's hand.
Yes, it would.
It would.
Okay. Any further discussion? We hear a motion. Oh, I'm sorry. We have other witnesses here. Susan Weirs, Weens, I mean, and John Reed, do you want to come up here together? Susan, you want to lead off? Sure.
My name is Susan Weens. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. Good morning, Senators. I'd like to say, first of all, Senator Kulongoska, that you stole all of my thunder and my testimony, and what you said is exactly our position. You have a copy of the written testimony before you. I'll just briefly go over that, because I think you've all heard basically my arguments. A very unsatisfactory condition exists in the state of Oregon in that once a worker is injured, he or she is for all practical purposes considered terminated. This does not happen in all cases, but it is prevalent. Many employers are afraid that once a worker is injured, he or she may become injured again or aggravate that previous injury, so they do not want to keep the injured worker after his recovery. Sometimes a worker who fills the injured worker's job during the recovery may be a better employee. Therefore, the employer wants to keep that new employee. Another reason that the employer may want to keep the new employee is the cost of parts of the fringe benefit package for which a new employee may not qualify for, possibly several years. In some labor agreements, certain new hires do not qualify for payment to be made on their behalf during probation period. That is, most vacations are earned after a certain amount of service. So a new employee then would not cost the employer a 2-week vacation until after he had been working for several months or sometimes years. We feel very confident that if an employer retains a handicapped employee, it will have a positive impact on the rest of the employees to work safely. The living example of what can happen will be displayed each and every day by the person who was injured. Safe working employees save money for the employer. I think all of us agree that if you see every day someone who has lost fingers or a hand as a result of his employment, that you would be more inclined to work safely. And it's a constant reminder. We feel that having these persons back on the job would be an incentive for the employees as well as the employer to be conscious of safety, perhaps to implement some further safety programs. And we feel it would be very beneficial all around. As Senator Kulongoski said, this concept is also encompassed in House Bill 3125, which is Crest's proposal. I think the language as far as reinstatement in 3125 reads, "The worker shall be reinstated by the employer to the former position of employment without reduction in wage if the worker is able to perform the primary duties of the position." I think if you were considering changing some of the language in that, you might want to look at some of the language in the Crest proposal, because it does align more specifically what reinstatement is and what would be effective reinstatement and would be good for the employee as well as the employer. We think that over the long range, the employer will save money on his or her workers and compensation premiums by retaining workers that were injured in his or her employee. We request the due pass on 199.
Chairman. Senator Trowe.
I'd like to say for those in the audience as well as for the committee members that Susan Weens is a student intern with the AFL-CIO during this legislative session. She's a student at Oregon State University. She's given very excellent testimony, and I think that shows what students can do up here learning the process. Thank you.
You're all, there's some new students that came in there. Where are the new ones from? You're all, well, I'll let you talk to your other people, and they can all tell you what we're up to up here. Do you have any questions, Susan?
Good testimony.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Mr. Reed.
My name is John Reed. I'm from Springfield, Oregon, and I have two matters to bring to your attention. One is, of course, my agreement with Senate Bill 199, because this is the chief reason for disabled people, especially back disabled people, not to get reemployed. Warehouse or timber company, for instance, examines people thoroughly before they hire them. If they find out you got a back problem, they send you to their position, often says you have a back strain instead of the real back trouble that you have. Gives you a job that will be irritating that you'll quit at. Hopefully you'll go to another employer who will have to indemnify you and take the risk and take the blame for the injury that happened at Weyerhaeuser. This story is actually happening. The other thing that I might talk about here is the insurance coverage. Now, it's unfair to the small entrepreneur in Oregon to suffer the higher insurance rates because he's a good guy and he takes back the injured employer. I know guys down in Eugene, for instance, garbage collectors and such, or people that hire 10 or less employees that gladly take their employees back. And then their insurance company comes in, Travelers Insurance Company, for instance, and doubles their damn indemnification, their policies, premiums, if you please. And that's totally unfair. So there has to be something to make this workable. Two things. One, some... set policy that we're not going to, number one, I think it should be a monopoly. Workman's compensation now is pretty well ruined by the collusion going on with the insurance industry in Oregon, keeping premiums artificially high. Therefore, the state acts insurance fund should be a monopoly, non-participant dating, and they should not raise their rates to employers that take the injured worker back. That's the key. The employers will not, no matter what they face in these punitive measures, which are really lacking in expression in this bill, though, by the way, they, for $100 or $500 fine, they're not going to take the employee back, especially back injured workers, if they know that their insurance rates are going to skyrocket for the whole category of employees they have, say 60 employees. It wouldn't be economically sound for them. So there has to be something in the bill that does two things. It relates to workman's comp, so it should be in the Workman's Compensation Act, too. And a part of it, saying that the State Acts Insurance Fund, nor any indemnifier in the state of Oregon, if we're not going to make a monopoly, can raise their rates because the employer takes the injured worker back. Number two, there should be something in there that the employer is not... I don't think you can write a lot of the things in. It's got to be just good faith. But the employer cannot, for instance, put the employee to jobs that are irritating, are jobs that are they won't advance, so they'll quit. In other words, they'll say, sure, I'll take you back. And they put the guy sorting chips or something like this, and they wouldn't ordinarily do that. Just for the idea that he's got a back problem, he'll have another one. And so they want to get rid of them, that type of thing. But the main thing that I say that I'm for this type of legislation, both for the labor commissioner's authority in the matter, as you know, I ran for labor commissioner this last time, and I am for it having being put into the 656, Oregon Vice Chapter 656, which worked in Compensation Act of 1965, which, by the way, is being decimated by the idea we don't have to give restitution in the Crist bill, and by the Senate Bill 48, and by 77 legislation, Senate Bill 1048 and 1050, where it took de novo review, circuit court away, and other things that are unconstitutionally been done to the worker already. We've already taken away their jury rights, the right to have their claim assessed by a jury of their peers. We've taken away the judges out of the act. There's no more.
Before, Mr. Chairman, before we get into that, Mr. Chairman, as far as the bill goes, I'm prepared to make a motion to send it to the floor.
Yeah, there's a bill set. There's a bill in the House which would also include this in the Workers' Comp Act, requiring that the employer hire him back, and you should testify before the House committee because they are having this.
Well, this bill 199 is what I'm addressing now.
That's right, 199.
I'm supportive. I also like to ask the chairman when I'll get a hearing on my Senate Bill 522. I've had several phone calls about it. And,
before you do that, Mr. Chairman, I have a motion before the committee to send this bill to the floor with a DuPass recommendation.
Motion is to send Senate Bill 199 to the floor with a DuPass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hanlon?
Aye.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Smith? Senator Troll?
Aye.
Senator Wingard? Senator Kulongas?
Aye.
Senator Groner?
Aye.
Dick, I'll carry if you want.
Carried. Okay, I'll answer your question as far as you want to talk to me after the meeting. Are there any other anything further to come before the committee?
Could I answer now, sir? I have other people to see, and I just don't know when
we'll have a hearing. We've got a lot of bills in this committee, and we'll have a hearing whenever.
I trust your integrity, sir. I don't want any more sparks between us. You know, I agree with you in many.